Welcome back to the Florida History Podcast. I'm Carter Krishnire.
And I'm Robert Bucciolato.
And we're opening a new season of the Florida History Podcast today. We've gone through our Florida Albion series of Colonial Florida. We've done a lot of stuff on the Seminole Wars. We've done some stuff on Silver Springs, which is obviously one of the most important attractions in Florida's history, actually, as we talk about on the podcast, the original tourist attraction, the original attraction that drew tourists to Florida. Now we're going to shift into another mode where we're going to talk about a lot of things from around the state. And we're going to start actually with a topic we've covered before, but it is the 50th anniversary of Watergate here in the summer of 1972. June of 1972 was the break-in. July of 1972 was when both the New York Times and the Washington Post sent reporters to Miami to get to the bottom of CNN doing a four-part series with a refreshed look at Watergate in the context of modern times. So let's talk about Watergate and Florida. And again, Robert, I'll throw it to you. We'll start with all the burglars were from Florida.
Yep, all the burglars were from Florida. To give just a little bit of insight, the Summer White House was one of the Summer White Houses, I should say, was located down here in South Florida. The president's neighbor had some dubious business connections with the underworld. So there was a lot of avenues that were open for him to contract these certain characters and also launder the money that was needed for their payment. It's important for everybody to remember that around this time in our history, the U.S. presidency had ballooned to this massive behemoth of a executive. There was a lot of powers that were brought in post-World War II and also during World War II. Some of them were emergency powers, and the actual role didn't really shrink back following this conflict the way that it did at the end of the Civil War when Congress sort of reasserted itself. So as a result, Congress had basically taken a pretty big backseat to what was going on during this time period. And so when you had a very authoritative president like Nixon, who around this time famously pointed to his desk and said, that's the Justice Department or that's the State Department. It was really just primed and ready for something like this to happen. And in one of the great anomalies of our politics, both the Republican and the Democratic primaries and conventions were located around the same time and around the same place. And so there was a lot of movement and a lot of activity here. Now, the burglars were contacted.
And both were in Miami, we have to mention. So it was an anomaly
that both
conventions were in Miami. Yeah. It was an anomaly. The Republican convention was supposed to be in San Diego. They had to pull it and move it to Miami late. The Democratic convention had been awarded. The DNC had been awarded to Miami. And also should mention that the initial planning for the entire intelligence operation of the Nixon campaign took place in Miami at Key Biscayne. So continue.
So they were all based, the burglars were based in South Florida. A lot of them were had connections to Cuban resistance, which Richard Nixon was always very involved in. He had really ingratiated himself in the 1960s, especially his view on Castro, which was a lot more hardline than Kennedy's. So he had a lot of loyalty in that area. There was a huge amount of fear that Nixon was going to be a one-term president among his administration. So there was a lot of involvement of shadowing Democratic candidates, and they almost had sort of a siege mentality built in. So it was really only natural for them in that mindset to decide to do something like the Watergate burglary. And eventually, after recruiting them, after briefing them, they went to the Watergate Hotel, which served as the actual headquarters to the DNC, and that was when they did their famous bungled burglary.
That is correct, and the intelligence operation was also based around wiretapping and bugging the Democratic Convention. So I want to mention a couple of things related to this. So obviously, we now know in hindsight that the 1972 election was a complete fraud. Edmund Muskie, Senator Muskie from Maine, was effectively had to withdraw from the Democratic race, the race for the Democratic nomination, because of dirty tricks, which also involved the Canuck letter, which involved someone from Florida reporting it, right, from Deerfield Beach, writing the letter that said, hey, I heard Muskie say this stuff. And also that a lot of that operation was based around culmination in the Democratic Convention, which was always slated to be in Miami, unlike the RNC, which was moved to Miami at a late date because of the situation in San Diego. Let's talk a little bit about the Washington Post and their editor, Catherine Graham, of course, had married into the, her family owned the Washington Post, but she had also married Phil Graham. So she married into the Graham family, which is a Florida family. And they had TV licenses, Robert. They had TV stations here in the state of Florida, WJXT in Jacksonville, WPLG, whose call letters spell out Phil L. Graham. So pretty dead giveaway that that's connected to the Washington Post. In Miami, Fort Lauderdale, among other TV stations. And Nixon, once the Post under Woodward and Bernstein started reporting on the Watergate break-in and were the only major paper pursuing it the way they did, and of course CBS News and some other news outlets were reporting what the Washington Post reported, but the Post were doing the digging. Catherine Graham was the publisher, obviously, and she stood by her reporters, Woodward and Bernstein, as did their editor, great editor Ben Bradley. Nixon and the Florida GOP and leading figures in the Florida GOP tried to come after, used the full force of government to come after the TV licenses of the Post Newsweek stations here in the state of Florida.
Well, not only that, but a lot of the records of some of these burglars were located in clerk of courts and state attorney's offices down here yes. in South Florida. And so they tried to put the pressure on them, Nixon Attorney General in particular, to bar access from the Washington Post of some of these pertinent documents. But it was really a situation where the Friends of Nixon, which was the organization that found out later was kind of laundering this money from the campaign, was very active in the state of Florida, and they made a lot of calls to the Washington Post. They tailed these reporters. Yep. They did a lot to try and subvert them and their investigation, and they tried to put a lot of financial pressure and emotional pressure on the actual newspaper and on the founders and on their families.
Yeah, and Richard Gerstein was the state attorney in Dade County. He was a Democrat. And Gerstein had actually invited a New York Times reporter down to Miami to talk about the Watergate investigation. Walter Rugeber was the New York Times reporter who then actually this call was made by Barry Sussman, not by Ben Bradley, who was the editor of the Washington Post, but by the city editor, Barry Sussman, who in the movie had a bit role, but really had a huge, huge role in terms of the actual Watergate investigation and was effectively cut out of the movie. But the decision to keep Bernstein in Miami and pursue that check is the reason the Washington Post ran forward with the story from that point forward. The New York Times hit a dead end. And it was the Post then that carried Watergate forward from late July 1972. But there was pressure even within the Democratic Party in Miami-Dade County. The mayor of Miami, who had succeeded Robert King High, who we've talked about in length on this podcast series, Robert, was David Kennedy, who became one of the national leaders of Democrats for Nixon. So Kennedy is involved with GOP donors in the Miami area and some other Democrats for Nixon to try and pressure Gerstein to block Carl Bernstein and Bob Woodward from access to these documents, and checks also, the bank accounts were all in Florida. There was a check deposited in a bank account in Boca Raton, which was kind of the smoking gun trigger on then connecting this back to CREEP, which was the committee to reelect.
And then they just basically followed the money from there. They also had some issue, which, you know, you had mentioned this one individual was a Democrat. The Florida Democratic Party really didn't want to touch this, and the Congress at the time really didn't want to touch this. Everybody had known that George McGovern was going to lose badly, and they knew that, in particular, he was going to lose Florida at historic levels. So even though the governor and the attorney general here in the state were, you know, lifelong strong Democrats, they really weren't doing any favors, and they weren't adding any equal pressure that these documents come out. That's something that you would expect today if there was, you know, a Democratic president or a Republican president that had issues and that party was of opposing sides. They would naturally be a little bit more accommodating and exert what power they had within their respective roles. That wasn't happening here, and a big reason why was so many of the presidents, not only the president's allies that were once Democrats coming into his fold, but so many of the Democratic Party's figures here in the state were idealistically opposed to George McGovern from the offset. So it was really an uphill battle for these two reporters.
Yeah, and a key difference that I keep mentioning between Watergate and the Trump scandals is that the Trump scandals were investigated right away. There was scrutiny right away. There was a media that was going after Trump. In the case of Nixon, I would say the majority of the media was complicit with him. That's why we didn't have Senate Watergate hearings until May of 1973. The Burglary takes place in June 17th of 1972. We had a presidential election in between that period, and you also had a situation where Democrats were scared. One Democrat, Congressman Wright Patman of Texas, from East Texas, who was a major opponent of the banking industry, you know, classic populist, he decided to open an investigation, got no support, got virtually no press coverage. And the general view that was put out there was that the Washington Post is on a fishing expedition. They've got a Kennedy Democrat as a publisher in Ben Bradley. They've got Katherine Graham, who's from a Democratic family, whose late husband, Phil Graham, had been an advisor to you know, had been close with LBJ. Katherine Graham herself was close with Bob McNamara. So it was very easy to paint this as a Democratic plot, a coup attempt by the Washington Post. In time, obviously, we celebrate Woodward and Bernstein and Graham and Bradley for a reason, but this was not clear in 1972. I mean, there were more people in the country who thought the Washington Post was a partisan left-wing paper going after Nixon for political reasons than believed that the burglary had been a serious thing.
And it's unfortunate because there was a lot of good Floridians that were active in that campaign that didn't understand what was happening, and unfortunately their names were associated with some of that money trail. And you see, yeah, one in particular in the movie All the President's Men, where, you know, he was just a normal run-of-the-mill, you know, donor, and he ended up having to pay ultimately a higher price than those that were deeply, deeply involved. And so, but at the time, it really was just, you know, they didn't want McGovern to talk about it during the campaign. Every time he did, his poll numbers went down. You know, the public was really just turned off. And then once they released the story, you know, it kind of spluttered the first time. Nobody really paid it any much attention. And then they released it again, you know, a different element of it, and it just erupted. It totally shattered the American presidency for a generation. It brought about huge, sweeping changes in campaign finance reform. It brought the Watergate baby generation into Congress, yep. And it made these two individuals household names.
Yeah, and that was the 74 Watergate baby campaign, Woodward and Bernstein. Just in closing, I will say that one of the things Woodward in particular has tracked since Watergate as a reporter is that presidents all operated in the shadow of Watergate. Obviously, Jimmy Carter was pretty clean as a whistle, but then you had Ronald Reagan and the Iran-Contra scandal, but there was the shadow of Watergate and how they operated. Same thing with the Clinton scandals, which were numerous in the 1990s. There were numerous small scandals. I don't think there was anything in the Clinton administration that rose to the level of a Watergate or some of the Trump scandals, but there were numerous kind of niggling, you know, Travelgate, Whitewater, all this sort of minor stuff, but it kind of adds up over time. But all of it, the way that the White House handled it was related to the way Watergate had gone down. Same thing with the way George W. Bush conducted himself. Donald Trump was really kind of the first post-Watergate president, the first president who was elected by a generation of people who have no memory of Watergate or no memory of kind of the lingering effects of Watergate. And look at what happened.
And it's so interesting because he's the first of these presidents since Nixon that you could say has a similar volume of associations and connections,
yeah,
to the Sunshine State.
He's almost
any of the other presidents that we've talked about.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So that's a great point, Rob. I was about to say he's almost identical to Nixon in terms of his personality and paranoia and insecurities. But yes, he's the first president since Nixon. I guess they're the only two presidents in history that have had this volume of connection to the Sunshine State. I mean, the Nixon, I consider basically a Floridian during his presidential tenure, even though he was registered to vote in New York at the time, believe it or not, not in California, where he had been a U.S. senator from and had run for governor. But the volume of Florida involvement in everything Nixon did, in fact, so much of the planning for this intelligence operation, and even then the planning of the cover-up, takes place not in Washington itself, but in Miami, in Key Biscayne.
Absolutely.
And obviously the number of Floridians associated with Richard Nixon was an incredible list. And before we go, I should mention, we didn't mention the name Bebe Rebozo, which maybe was an omission on our part. One of Nixon's closest associates, of course, was Miami-based Bebe Rebozo. One other point I would make is that these Cubans that had been involved in the burglary had been used by Nixon operatives, Howard Hahn, Chuck Colson, those really dirty figures. They had been used in previous operations. You're right, Robert, in saying they had come from the Cuban exile community, which was very close to Nixon personally in terms of political terms, and also with a lot of Nixon's associates. And they hadn't bungled one of these operations before. So they were thought, one of the things that's come out in more recent research, and now Woodward and Bernstein themselves have talked about, is that they bungled the Watergate break-in. But these were professionals, basically, at this that had been used for intelligence purposes by the Nixon people, because they felt like they didn't want to train new criminals, first of all. And secondly, these guys were ideological zealots, right? They were anti-communist, pro-Nixon zealots. They believed everything they were doing was for that man, and they were in some sort of cult of personality of Nixon, which, you know, you can say about a lot of supporters of Donald Trump and other people, too. I mean, you can argue that about some Democrats also, that they have personality cults around them. But that was really kind of the fundamental thing, was that you had this Miami-based crew of burglars who were zealots. And they were zealots in support of Richard Nixon personally. I guess one last thing from you, Robert, like your take on this is that obviously there was a lingering resentment towards the Kennedys and John Kennedy in particular in the Cuban American community in Miami. How much of that drove that community towards the zealotry in favor of Nixon and created the elements for all of this?
It was the driving force. At the end of the day, Kennedy really did a number on the community in terms of the Bay of Pigs fiasco. It's one of those things when you're scorned by somebody, and then you have this person like Nixon who barely lost the election by the popular vote, who seems as this very available alternative to what you desire and what you want. And you have these people that are, you know, they're first generation immigrants who want desperately to return to their country, which their country was run on sort of, you know, I'd say conservative, authoritative person who yep. shares a lot of the idealistic characteristics of the Republican Party. So it's just a natural fit. And then the fact that him and his backers repeatedly met throughout the 1960s, even when he was not in politics actively, nurturing that sort of connection. And a lot of them, not talking about the burglars, but a lot of the more healed and well-to-do members of that immigrant class brought from Cuba to the United States their money with them. And so they were generous backers. So it was really just a no-brainer from them at the beginning that they would support him because he had a more, I'd say, militant view about the Cuban situation and actively wanted, at least he was saying to them, to murder Castro.
Yeah, and in fact, there was one of the documentaries on Watergate, which mentioned that one of these Cubans had said of Richard Nixon, if he had been president if he had won the presidency in 1960, we know Castro wouldn't be in Cuba anymore. Now, there's absolutely nothing. I mean, every kind of U.S. policy, every kind of U.S. president hasn't been able to dislodge the Castro family from control of Cuba. But we're saying that with some hindsight now, right? Early 1970s, that wasn't abundantly clear. Robert, thank you as always. That was fantastic. And we'll be back next week with another new edition of the Florida History Podcast.